May it please the court. My name is Roger Yorgis, and I'm newly with the law firm of Steptoe and Johnson in Washington, D.C., here to represent the appellant American Cyanamide Company. Testing polio vaccine are all complex, complicated matters with jargon terms familiar to scientists, to virologists. In fact, some of the terms are probably more familiar to farmers, like words like seeds and harvests. But while those terms are familiar to people who are not in this courtroom, the basic legal concepts that govern this case are quite familiar to everybody on this bench and to all the lawyers that occupy the courtroom. There are two issues that are dispositive of this appeal, as we submit, and both implicate the testimony of plaintiff's expert witness, Thomas Basso. Thomas Basso was proffered to testify as a so-called regulatory expert. His job and his proffer was to identify various transgressions or alleged transgressions that American Cyanamide engaged in the course of producing and testing polio vaccine. What this entire case turned on, at least the liability portion of this case turned on, was what is a seed? We all remember the law school case, contract case of what is chicken. This case is what is a seed? And in determining what a seed is, Mr. Basso looked to, and the liability in this case turns on, a violation of an FDA regulation. The first issue in this case, we contend, is whether it was appropriate in the first instance to allow Mr. Basso to testify when the question of what seed means under the FDA regulations was hotly disputed between the parties. Mr. Basso took the position that any time you take vaccine materials and grow out another generation of vaccine materials, the thing used to grow the next generation is a seed, and therefore the FDA's regulations relating to seed testing are always implicated. Mr. Basso said that Cyanamide failed to test materials known as the original Sabin strains and materials also referred to as intermediate materials or seeds. American Cyanamide's position, which was supported by the record here and now supported again by the FDA, which has appeared in this court as amicus, has been that the word seed has a very specific meaning insofar as the FDA regulations are concerned. And that word seed applies only to the production seeds, that is, the materials that are used to make the final vaccine. There is no dispute in this case, Your Honors, that the production seeds were tested and that the final vaccine was tested. And Mr. Basso himself conceded that and said that those tests were compliant. What we argued to the court many times in a motion in limine, we argued it at voir dire, trying to exclude Mr. Basso from testifying, is that because this word seed was at issue in this case, and because that comes from a regulation, it was up to the court to decide that. Matters of law are up to the court to decide, not for a jury or for an expert witness to testify about. And fundamentally, we argue that is where the first primary error occurred in this case. Mr. Basso was allowed to testify about a matter that should have been within the court's province.
Did the court ever make any preliminary determination of that issue before deciding that it was a fact question for the jury?
The court never did. We raised the issue several times, Your Honor, and the court just declined to rule on it and allow the testimony to come in without specifying one way or the other what his reasoning was. The objections were made, objections were overruled, trial moved on.
Did the court ever, I'm trying to figure out, if we were to agree for sake of argument with the argument that the meaning of the regulation is a question of law for the court and not a question of fact for the jury, what effect did that have here? Did the judge otherwise indicate he agreed with what the jury ultimately must have determined, or in some other way in response to the motion for new trial or at some other point indicate that he believed that seed referred to the intermediate lots as well as to...
I submit the judge never made any kind of an express determination that way. I suppose with the one-sentence denial of the motion for directed verdict and the JNOV, one could imply all sorts of things, given that one of our grounds was that this question was a legal question for the court to decide in the first instance. But the record is devoid of any determination on the central legal question.
And he had determined that was not an issue for him explicitly on the record?
He never determined it one way or the other.
I mean, he said explicitly, this is for the jury, not for me.
Whether he said that explicitly, it's hard to know. What we know is that we said it is for you, Judge, and he said overruled, let the jury determine this.
Can we infer from that that he accepted Bazo's definitions and terminology as governing, or at least as credible and admissible and proper? Can we infer that he made a determination, basically lining up with Bazo?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that is you can certainly infer that he concluded that Bazo's testimony was admissible because he did admit it. I think it's a stretch to have this case rest on an inference that the judge made some legal conclusion that's dispositive of the case. And by the way, if he did make that determination, he was wrong as a matter of law, and that's what this court does. It sits de novo on questions of law. So I don't think there's anything wrong with this court saying even if he did make that determination implicitly, and that's the best one could say.
Did he expressly say that he was rejecting any FDA interpretation?
He never said that. He never said that.
Was that presented to him, the FDA interpretation?
The FDA interpretation was presented to him in two important ways. Three, actually. One is, and this isn't the FDA determination, this is actually the regulation itself. The regulation speaks of seeds used to make vaccine. We contend that the only sensible definition of that is the production seed. That's the material used to make vaccine. One provision of the regulation that plaintiffs completely ignore in this case is 630, this is 21 CFR 630.10b5, which speaks specifically of production seeds. Plaintiffs say the term production seed doesn't exist in the regulations. That's wrong. 630.10b5 specifically says when new production seeds come online, they must be tested for monkey neurovirulence. That's precisely what happened here when the three production seeds used to make Strong's vaccine came online in the 1970s and early 1980s. So the phrase production seed is in fact specified in the regulations in a provision of the regulations that applies directly to this case.
And that regulation was enforced prior to the production of the vaccine at issue.
That's precisely right. And as the FDA makes clear in its amicus brief, it's always been how it's enforced that regulation. The other evidence that was before
you. But you seem to take the position in your brief that we're bound by it. You said we have to defer to it, but basically we're it's not really a deference you're saying. You're saying we're bound by it. We can't come to some other conclusion without being unreasonable.
I think that the compelling conclusion is as we submit the word seed means. The court does not have to blindly defer to a regulatory body's interpretation of its regulations. But under Chevron and other Supreme Court decisions, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and we're dealing with a federal regulation here, substantial deference is due to the agency. I'm not saying blind deference, but substantial deference.
After it became apparent that your motion in limine was unsuccessful and that your attempts to prevent Bazo from testifying were not fruitful, was there anything preventing you from producing an FDA witness to counter the plaintiff's witness?
There was nothing preventing us, I suppose, from producing a former FDA witness. Getting a current FDA witness runs into all kinds of obstacles, as the FDA has pointed out in its amicus brief. But this wasn't an evidentiary question. This is a legal question. It's not a question that's informed by the testimony of a witness. It's a pure legal question informed by the tools, the interpretive tools that every court has at its disposal.
The language. Even if it were submitted to the judge, you're saying it would be error to get any assistance from FDA officials or former officials on what the regulation meant and what how the FDA interpreted it to guide the court in its interpretation?
I'm not saying that would be error.
Okay.
If that's how this case went down. I'm saying, though, that first and foremost, a court typically won't call in legislators or regulators to ask them what the law meant. I think that would sort of create chaos in the system.
Doesn't the jury have to have some understanding of the regulatory scheme in order to reach its factual conclusion?
I think here what the jury needed to have was someone instructing the jury whether the word seed included what the plaintiff said it included.
So what you're suggesting is that the court should have interrupted the trial and given the jury a lesson in the law?
I'm suggesting what the court should have done was never let this case go to the jury. Because there's no question of fact here about what was and wasn't tested.
But the statute that we have that governs expert witness testimony, which is significantly different from the federal rule, just says if scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact understand the evidence or determine a fact and issue. And so doesn't say that laws for the court and facts are for the expert or opinions are for the expert. It just says, will some specialized knowledge assist the jury in its determination?
In its determination of fact, Your Honor, not its determination of law. I think that's implicit in that rule and every other rule that says that juries determine facts, not law. Now, I need to leave a little bit of time.
But it's in the context of the regulatory scheme, I would assume.
It still is a legal question, and it's a legal question that should have been decided here by the judge, not by the jury. And if there was no question about what the word seed meant, it would be a very different case. But given the fact that there was a central question about what the law meant, the meaning of the law is a matter of law.
And before you sit down, and I'll give you whatever time this takes to answer this question in addition, you're saying that it was error to submit the question of what the regulation meant to the jury, but how do instructions 7 and 9 submit that issue? I mean, it's sort of subsumed within the fact that the court didn't make a ruling, but implicitly, didn't the court somehow do it? Because it didn't. I was just finding the instructions, and they asked the jury to find whether or not it was in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous, or whether it was negligent not to test those. But it doesn't say, did they violate the regulations, or pin it on, tie it to violating the regulations.
But that is the only theory on which this case proceeded. The plaintiffs did not point to an industry standard or anything like that. The only theory they proceeded on was that the defendant violated the federal regulations, and that should result in liability.
Had the court determined that defendant violated the regulations, these would have been appropriate instructions.
That's right. We would have been arguing that they were wrong because, as a matter of law, they hadn't violated the regulations.
Right.
The defendant hadn't violated
but
the regulations.
But you would have been arguing the question of law was wrongly decided as
Correct.
Opposed to the question of fact.
And if, as one of the other justices mentioned, one of the judges mentioned, if there's some implicit determination of law that the court can divine here, we would argue that is wrong. And our first point is, as a matter of law, this case shouldn't have gone to the jury because the question of what a seed is a legal question that must be resolved in our favor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Lisa Howe.
You get about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, just so you know.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Howe, and I represent cross-respondent Dr. Jawad. The plaintiff, cross-appellant, raised the issue against defendant, cross-respondent Jawad, in the Missouri Court of Appeals regarding whether they should have been allowed to use the deposition of Dr. Deal as rebuttal evidence. The Missouri Court of Appeals upheld the jury's verdict in favor of defendant, cross-respondent Jawad. The plaintiff cross-appellant did not seek further relief or review on this issue with the Supreme Court. That is suggestive that the plaintiff cross-appellant does not think that this particular issue or appeal is meritorious. Otherwise, the plaintiff would have sought to have his appeal heard by this honorable court.
Or maybe they just made a cost-benefit analysis. Decided, but go ahead.
Yeah, you're basically saying because they didn't apply for rehearing on that or transfer on that issue that they don't really believe it. Is that your argument?
That is my argument.
Okay.
If we were going to the merits of it, I was unclear. The part of the testimony that was quoted in the brief, Dr. Deal just said what she personally did and that she personally warned about both. Did she also go on to testify that that was the standard of care and that doctors in general do that?
I do not believe that she did, Your Honor. My belief is that Dr. Deal testified that she personally would have offered the alternative IPV, but she also testified that she would follow the Red Book. And the Red Book doesn't require a physician to offer IPV. It only does in certain circumstances. The appellate review of an error alleged in the admission or exclusion of evidence is limited to an abuse of discretion standard. The focus is not on whether the evidence was admissible, but on whether the trial court abused its discretion. That's in Aliff versus Cody. The trial court's discretion has to be clearly against the logic of circumstances and so arbitrary and unreasonable as to shock the sense of justice and indicate a lack of careful consideration. Cross-respondent Jawad did not testify on direct examination that she did not advise Cortez Strong's mother of IPV. She never used the word standard of care at any time in her testimony, and in fact, she offered no evidence in her case whatsoever on the issue of standard of care or whether her conduct complied with the standard of care. No new issue was raised by Dr. Jawad regarding the standard of care. The only evidence offered regarding the standard of care was through the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Shansky, on direct examination. The deposition of Dr. Deal would not serve to repel, counteract, or disprove the testimony of Respondent Jawad or her evidence. The Honorable Court held in Bean versus Brittle, this Honorable Court, that the admissibility of rebuttal evidence is within the discretion of the trial court. But this court further held that one cannot, as a matter of right, offer in rebuttal evidence which was proper or should have been introduced in chief. Dr. Deal had been cross-examined, cross-endorsed as an expert by the plaintiff, and could have been called during the plaintiff's case in chief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This is not a case about the great contours of tort law. This is a very narrow case. It's about an unavoidably unsafe product. It's about a product where society has determined that the benefit of that product far outweighs the risks that individuals may assume. And the law, in fact, gives manufacturers of vaccines an absolute defense if they follow every one of the safety protocols that are required. The reason I believe that that comment K defense was not pled in this case is because the tests weren't done. And so the question becomes in this case whether or not the failure to do those tests results in liability when an individual receives polio when they get an uncompletely tested vaccine. Now, American Cyanamid's position has been throughout that Mr. Bozzo should not be allowed to testify. But that's a very odd sort of way to get at what was, in the end, I would suggest to the court, and I think Judge Smart asked this question, what the court concluded because it agreed to submit instruction number 9, that testing was required on all of these particular different parts of the manufacturing process. Now, there's really a couple of ways to get at, are the tests required? A lot of the argument that you see in the brief and has been made in the trial court was about a 1991 regulation that was designed to go backwards. We spend a lot of time on the brief talking about how the FDA had been found itself negligent in the polio vaccine field. And it had been required to pay judgments to people who had gotten polio. And the regulations come from two places. One, which I'm going to call 630.10B, which requires neurovirulence testing at each one of the steps of the production process. And the other says that you have to test seed viruses that subsequently in the chain of manufacture are used to make the vaccine. Well, the chart that we provided you behind tab 1 and here in large form shows you each tissue culture passage. Now, I'm sure we're going to hear from Mr. Yorgas that we didn't bring this up at trial in Mr. Bozzo's testimony. But their expert, Dr. Ritchie, is the one who testified about the need for tests at each tissue culture passage. It's what Berkovitz at the United States Supreme Court said, at each tissue culture passage, and that's each one of those solid black lines, there has to be neurovirulence testing. And as Mr. Yorgas told you, there is no dispute in this case. There was nothing tested in that yellow block.
So are you saying no deference should be given to the FDA's interpretation?
Well, I don't think the FDA comes into this case with clean hands, first. Second, every case that looked at what the...
But that would be true in every case since they regulate everything. You'd, in effect, be saying they could never testify?
No, Your Honor. I believe they can say what they think it said. But even if you take what they say now as true, and I would invite you then to turn back in this little booklet that we've given you to the 1991 regulations. They say that the things that we're going to say are not seeds any longer, but they're strains, are SO, SOM, it's behind tab 4, and SOR. Well, you see, this all starts with SOM. And even if you didn't have to test that, There is nothing that the FDA has said in the evidence in this case that go to 701S and 801S.
You're saying their 1991 regulation just dealt with the master seeds and not the intermediate seeds?
The 87 regulations, which were applicable when this vaccine was made, did not say that SOM was not also a seed. And there is a tissue culture passage between the master strain and the first master seed.
You know, assuming we were to accept all your arguments and accept that it was a violation of FDA regulations, the second key issue, which there wasn't time to get to in the initial argument, is causation. And if I understand what you're saying, in effect, you're saying that if you fail to do testing, you're liable for anybody who gets the disease, because you have to presume that, because by not testing, you don't know if there was a virulent strain, some part of the culture that had more greater virulence to it, and therefore it might have been more virulent, and therefore it might have been the cause.
I think, Your Honor, to say it a little differently, what we're suggesting to you is that when you have an unavoidably unsafe product, when the best defense that the manufacturer of the vaccine has is that you can never prove, whether we made the testing or not, that this person would not have gotten the polio if we'd done the test.
But did you offer any kind of other evidence, for instance, some comparison of strains that had been produced with that testing versus without, and you had 50 cases naturally and you had 100 cases in strains that had not been gone through this extra testing process? Because you're saying if you had 51 instead of 50, I mean, each one of you is trying to say, in effect, that you're arguing they would be saying, well, you can never prove any individual case was caused by it. But you're saying, in effect, you're shifting the burden of proof and saying they can never prove any individual case is not caused by it. Isn't there some in-between where there's actual evidence of an increased number of cases where you don't do testing than when you do, as opposed to simply a theoretical possibility that there might be an increased number of cases?
Well, Your Honor, I can't speak outside the record, and so I won't. The record in this case is the record in this case. And there's lots of things that we could talk about, unusually increased incidence of polio in Missouri around this period of time. That's not in the record, and you can't rely on it. What we can say is that the testimony at trial was that but for their failure to test, this was made more dangerous than it should have been.
Well, the testimony, I assume that, and there was some reference to Dr. Burris's testimony. I gather from that polio does not occur because it's not in the population. And so the only way that polio gets in the population, polio was in the population when I was a child, but after everybody got vaccinated, there's no reservoir of polio in the American population, so it has to come from the product. Is that the assumption?
The evidence in the case is that there is no such thing now as polio that's not vaccine associated.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., right. And I'm sorry, I didn't realize that Mr. Smart did not pass these out to you all. It's a copy of this stuff for you, if the court would permit. So the answer is, and Dr. Burris clearly said, this is vaccine associated polio. The only way Cortez Strong could have gotten this polio was from this vaccine. Their defense is, well, you can't prove beyond whatever the standard is that but for the failure to test, he would have gotten the vaccine.
And that's because there's some inherent risk in the vaccine.
Inherent risk in the vaccine.
But did you prove, did he say anything more than just, well, if you don't test things, there's always a possible test would have found something. You never know. Or was there some sort of evidence that untested vaccine, in fact, presents a greater risk, not to this particular plaintiff, but just in general, that untested vaccine has a higher incidence of polio cases?
What we know and what the evidence is from Dr. Richard is that at every one of these tissue culture passages, there is a possibility that the virus changes its characteristics. I put that in the little book that I've given you, that testimony. And so the reason, and the Sabin case also says that there's been findings that if you go past five tissue culture passages, the stuff oftentimes, not often, but sometimes will go back to its wild state for reasons that no one knows. So the testing has to be done at each level, and it's neurovirulent testing. under the 1987 regulations, simply to assure that that particular batch has not suddenly become, for reasons science can't really explain, neurovirulent again. And that, those tests, by all parties' agreement, were not done.
Mr. Well, there's a scientific protocol that, that the manufacturer probably defines to make sure it's safe. That's their duty to if they're going to produce it and put it out to the public, they have to have a scientific protocol which they define on how to make sure it, when it's delivered to the public, it is safe.
Your Honor, that's what the regulations required. And as to 801 and 701S, still require, you've got to have this neurovirulence testing between each tissue culture passage to make sure that whatever happens in the magic of DNA or RNA or whatever it is hasn't turned this back into something that's more dangerous than it should be. And the policy question, Chief Justice, you apparently had a question.
Well, go ahead and finish answering.
Well, the policy question that you have to face today is whether or not you're going to adopt the language, it seems to me, of the Sixth Circuit, which says if there is evidence that it is made more dangerous than it would ordinarily have been because of their failure to test, that's enough for liability.
And that actually was my question, so let me address that. Is there evidence it was more dangerous or evidence that there's a risk it was more dangerous? And we don't know.
I think the testimony of Mr. Bazo speaks of itself, and he says it increases the risk of danger.
Is there any basis for saying it actually increased the dangerousness, so we know that means it has more neural virulence? If it's more dangerous, or is it simply there's a risk since we didn't test it? We don't know if it was more dangerous.
Well, because they didn't test it, Your Honor, we can never know whether it would have passed or not. And the question becomes, who bears the burden for that?
And I think that's right, but is that how it was submitted? I mean, it seems like it's more like saying disfoliation of evidence or, you know, less a shift in the burden of proof because you can't go back in time and test it. But I didn't see it's submitted that way or arguments that way, but that's almost the effect of what you're arguing.
Your Honor, I believe the question was asked and answered without objection based on the Graham standard, which is failure to test increased the risk of Cortez Strong contracting polio, increased the risk of him contracting polio.
Of course, we don't want a control system where we say, well, we're going to put some untested polio out there and see if how many people are going to get it versus being tested. That's ridiculous. We have to protect the public in some kind of protocols and deal with it that way. There's no way we can say, well, let's see if some people are going to get polio if we don't test it.
Well, and I think, Your Honor, that's why Comment K is in place. It basically says that if you do everything you're supposed to do, you have an affirmative defense. Here they didn't. They didn't do everything they were supposed to do. And so the question is, what do you have to do to get to liability? Prosser suggests that one is liable if the defects make the product more dangerous than it would have been without the defect. Well, increasing the risk, I respectfully submit, makes it more dangerous. And that's the conundrum that we're in here on the causation question.
And is this only on the strict liability causation?
Well, Your Honor, we think it applies on both the negligent manufacturer and the other. But it's clearly that Mr. Bazo clearly made the case for it's defective under the comment the GH and I sections of restatement because it is more dangerous than the consumer would have expected it to be because of the test we submit.
I don't mean to quibble, but it seems to me though the heart of this is it ever been proved more dangerous, or is what you proved that there was a risk that it was more dangerous?
Well, I think, Your Honor,
when that Boswell's testimony, there's a risk that it's more dangerous.
Yes.
So there's kind of a double hit there, not just a straight.
I think that's fair, and I think that's the right distinction. And frankly, we go back to the question, the broad policy question. Who's going to bear this risk?
I'm wondering if this is more akin to Judge Thomas's case on an increased risk of survival mm-hmm. than it is to anything exactly. else. Exactly. You remember when?
Callahan. Is it Callahan? I'm sorry.
Callahan. Yeah. Callahan. If this is more akin to, you remember Judge Thomas wrote that opinion that said, you know, if you increase the risk to the person mm-hmm. of their not surviving or increase the mm-hmm. risk of injury. That there might be a liability there.
Well, that's clearly what we have. And if you look at Section 323 of the Restatement of Torts, it kind of heads in that direction as well. Now, it's never been fully fleshed out in this state, though mentioned that we found in three or four cases. So just to finish up this part of it, if you accept American Cyanamid's argument, there's never going to be an incentive for anybody to test, because and you have an unavoidably unsafe product. And why waste the money on testing? Because they're always going to say you can't prove that they wouldn't have gotten it anyway if we'd have done everything safely. And that's why I said at the beginning, we're in a very little narrow territory of the law here. We're not out there in the car accident causation place. We are in this place so very narrow. In fact, you can't even, except very specially, get this live polio vaccine in the United States anymore. They only give the dead stuff.
But in effect, we'd be changing. I mean, Instruction 7 on strict liability says plaintiff was damaged as a direct result of such defective condition, and the negligence instruction said the defendant failed to use ordinary care in manufacturing it, and as a direct result of such failure, plaintiff sustained damage. And in effect, you're saying there should be a presumption of that causation once you show the defect or once you show the negligent failure to test, and their burden to come back and show that, in fact, it didn't cause it because of the inability to go back in time and find evidence when testing wasn't done?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and quite frankly, it's, you know, it's to their benefit not to test under the argument they make.
Going back to that first argument, because you're otherwise out of time, the interpretation of issues of law are always for the court, not for the jury. I'm not talking about mixed questions, but what a statute says, we never submit to the jury.
That's correct.
Regulations, what a regulation says, what it means is a question of law for the court. Whether it was complied with is a question of fact.
And that's all Mr. Bazo was asked to testify to. Every time there was a question about interpretation of the regulation, with one exception, but always it was this. After Mr. Donovan, Mr. Georges' former partner, asked him what he thought the regulation meant, and he fought him in his... This was all invited error, Your Honor. Even if you reach the point where you just discussed, you have to get past the fact that this was all invited error. And not only that, he went ahead and asked Mr. Bazo about what the 1991 regulation meant on a repeated basis. And then Dr. Ritchie was also asked to give her views on behalf of American Cyanamid about what the regulations meant.
And wasn't your expert a former compliance officer?
He was, Your Honor.
So that was his area of expertise?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's why he was there to talk about. If you look at the question first proffered by Mr. Copps, it was, are you willing to tell the jury about American Cyanamid's compliance with the FDA regulations?
Didn't you need to have the court decide first what it meant before you could have his testimony as to that it didn't, in fact, didn't comply with what it meant?
Well, Your Honor, in a perfect world, yes. But Judge Ulmer took a look at that in the second summary judgment motion and didn't rule it the way that American Cyanamid wanted it to do. And Judge Calvin worked through this and however he decided to work through it, but he never asked the jury to determine what it meant. He merely said to the jury in the end, did they test or not test? Which implies, and I think more than that, it infers that the judge reached the conclusion that the testing was required under the regulations in effect at the time this vaccine was made. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
Causation. There is no but-for causation. There is no proximate causation in a case like this where there is an inherent risk in the product. The Fourth Circuit's analysis and the Sixth Circuit's analysis are on all fours with centuries of proximate cause law
in
this
jurisdiction. If we accept that, though, in effect, isn't every plaintiff who gets polio after taking the vaccine out of court, because you can never prove you wouldn't have gotten it in the absence of...
Absolutely not, Chief Justice. You hit the nail right on the head. There are ways that with the proper experts you could prove that the failure to test here actually increased the risk the court tests strong. You could, for example, compare the vaccines produced here against oral polio vaccines produced everywhere in the world. This is a worldwide vaccine produced by many manufacturers. You could, as plaintiffs have done in other litigation, not involving neurovirulence, but other questions about polio vaccine, ask for samples of the vaccine. They could have asked for samples of the original strains and samples of 701S and 801S and tested them to see whether those test results suggested there be some problem with downstream product. But let me say this. Bazo's testimony, Your Honors, does not come close to satisfying this court's standards. If it does, this court's standards of proximate cause will be eroded and essentially sort of a meaningless formulaic standard.
There are two possibilities here. Either Cortez Strong was an unfortunate
recipient of polio vaccine who got polio from the vaccine. That happens. It's known. It's disclosed. It is a known risk. Or something American Cyanamid did or didn't do caused him to get polio. That's at the heart of the Sixth and Fourth Circuits rulings in those cases, SLU, Graham, and Lundy. I would contend this.
Do those circuit court rulings preclude this court from saying that if the court were to agree with the plaintiff's interpretation of the regulation, that the showing that not all the tests were done creates a prima facie case, like Chief Justice was talking about? And so, in effect, the burden shifts. Do those cases preclude this court I know they don't preclude, but would they be inconsistent?
They certainly would be inconsistent, particularly the Fourth Circuit case that said any shifting of the burden and the Sixth Circuit case would be inconsistent with Missouri law. That would be unprecedented. And I think what's important here is to recognize that Bazo's testimony was couched solely in terms of possibilities, the possibility that there was an increased risk. Your Honors, anyone could say that. That falls squarely, I would say, in the nebulous twilight of conjecture, speculation, and surmise. That's exactly what Bazo's testimony was here, and it was not enough to establish proximate cause, either proximate cause or but-for causation. I would say, Your Honor, there's nothing that would preclude this court, except its own precedent, from shifting the burden to Cyanamid to disprove causation. Plaintiffs could do it here. It's not an easy case. It would be difficult. It would require a great deal of expertise by the proper expert. But that doesn't mean that Cyanamid is automatically liable for violating a regulation, as plaintiffs contend here.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.